MechCast, Wednesday, July 6th, 2016. Hey, MechGeeks, it's time for your MechCast, the show for MechGeeks by MechGeeks. I'm Adam, and this is the show where we discuss all things Macintosh. How you doing? Welcome back to the MechCast. Glad to have you back here with me for yet another episode. We've got quite a few things to talk about in this episode and some great feedback and comments from you as well. We're going to get into a number of items, including some possible updates to iPhone 7 storage, a little tiff between Spotify and Apple, a long-running Apple shop shutting down here in the States. Apple has a couple new betas out. There's potentially a new malware that you may want to watch out for with your Mac. So we have that, and then listener feedback. Some of you wrote in to comment on my external USB drive issue, the mounting-unmounting issue. I've got some new iLife, or iDevice hacks, rather. Life hacks, that's what I want to say. iDevice life hacks, which is something we were talking about on the last episode. A question about optimized iCloud storage. Going to talk a little bit about Wi-Fi Assist and then how to get help from Apple anywhere, anytime. So stay tuned for all of that. But before we get into it, I do want to take a quick moment and thank one of my show sponsors, and that is Gazelle. Hey, if you've got an old Apple device lying around, maybe an old MacBook, maybe an iPhone, maybe an iPad, and you want to get cash for it and you want to make it super easy on yourself, you don't want to deal with the hassles of, you know, online sales or placing classified ads or any of that sort of thing, check out Gazelle. Gazelle makes it really easy to sell your used Apple products. It's easy and free to get a quote online. All you have to do is go to gazelle.com, answer a few easy questions, and you will get an instant price quote. And you don't even have to worry if your device is broken. Gazelle will often accept those as well. So head over to the site, give them a try. And what's great is once you see the offer on your screen, that offer is honored for 30 days. So you have 30 days to decide, lock in your price, and they pay for shipping, and in many cases will even send you a box to send your device in with. So you don't have to worry about finding that either. It couldn't be simpler. When they receive your device, they take care of erasing and removing all of the personal information. And you get paid fast. All they're going to do is check it out, make sure it matches the condition, has the accessories that you said when you went through your price quote. As long as that matches up, hey, they're going to send it to you. And sometimes, not all the time, but every once in a while, they'll find that it's in better condition than even you thought it was. And you may even get a little extra. And you get paid fast, a check in the mail, by Amazon gift card, or direct deposit into a PayPal account. And Gazelle has served over a million customers. They've paid out hundreds of millions of dollars to those customers over the years. So you can get cash for your old iPhone, iPad, or Mac today. Just go to gazelle.com. Check them out. I've used them many times. It's great service. And a big thank you to them for their support of the MacCast. So believe it or not, there are some new iPhone 7 rumors coming out. I know we've heard many, many things about the iPhone 7. We probably know most of what it's going to look like. You know, the big news is no headphone jack, the dual camera on the iPhone 7 Plus. We've talked about all these things. But this week, we've got a couple rumors about storage sizes. And I know we've heard about storage sizes in the past, but this time around, there's a new rumor with kind of a different breakout of storage sizes. And I am not sure which one of these I'm more apt to believe. Well, there's one part of the story that I believe wholeheartedly. The other one I'm not quite as sure about. First out, we have Chinese site WeChat. They say that Apple is going to ditch the 16 gigabyte base model. Okay, good so far. And replace it with a 32 gigabyte. I think that is likely to happen. Now, what happens next is they say the breakdown is going to be 32, 128, 256 gigabyte. We've heard 32, 64, 128, which would kind of line up with where we're at right now with simply the 32 replacing the 16 gigabyte. So possibility, maybe, maybe not. But where the Chinese rumor falls apart is they also say that the iPhone 7 is going to be offered in three variants. iPhone 7, 7 Plus, which we've heard before, and an iPhone Pro model. Presumably, I would imagine that would mean the 256 gigabyte storage option would be the Pro. I don't think Apple's going to confuse the lineup like that. I think they're going to stick with iPhone 7, iPhone 7 Plus. And as far as the storage breakdown, 32, 128, 256 sounds really nice. And maybe that's what I'd like Apple to do. What I think they're more likely to do is 32, 64, 128, or maybe 32, 64, 256. Although they just bumped up to 256 on the iPads. I don't know if 256 is going to make it on the iPhone this go around, but I guess we're going to have to wait and see. The one part of this rumor from the Chinese site that seems to be confirmed by the Wall Street Journal, although they didn't comment on the upper ranges of storage size, but they did confirm that their sources told them that the entry-level model will come in with 32 gigabytes of storage. So that's good news for a lot of people who have been complaining for a while that 16 gigabytes just is not enough. And as a dad with a couple kids who have 16 gigabyte iPad minis, I can attest to this. This has become a big source of contention in my house, managing storage on a smaller storage device, iOS device. It is not fun. And there is just a lot of frustration and yelling. And I won't say throwing of iPads because that would not be good, but it gets close. I worry every once in a while that one might come flying across the room. So good to hear that Apple is finally ditching that 16 gigabyte size. I would argue 32 might not even be enough in this day and age, especially with all the things that are going on to our iOS devices now. But I'd love to get your opinion. I know some of you survive with 16 gigabyte, so chime in, let us know about that. If you think the storage sizes should be bigger, what do you think the storage sizes will be? I'm betting on 32, 64, 128. But whatever the storage sizes are, it looks like TSMC might come out on the good side selling Apple's A10 processors that will power the new iPhone 7. DigiTimes is reporting that they TSMC, expects to see almost a 20% sequential revenue growth in the third quarter of this year. Now, they don't say why exactly, right? Because they can't do that. But it's nicely coinciding with the time that they'll be supplying, guess who, Apple, with most, if not all, of the processors for their new iPhone. There's been a rumor that TSMC may be the sole supplier of the A10 chips for the iPhone 7, iPhone 7 Plus. And if so, that would give them a nice little sequential bump in revenue next quarter. Now, typically, Apple also does split orders with Samsung, but more and more, they've tried to kind of move away from them since Samsung makes competing products. They've kind of had this frenemy relationship for a while, and Apple's wanted to move away. Historically, TSMC just hasn't been able to supply the volume, but they've made factory investments. Maybe that combined with slightly reduced order quantities that we've been hearing about, Apple's supposedly being a little bit more conservative about their order volumes. And it may be combining those factors that TSMC, Taiwan Semiconductor Manufacturing Company, I can never remember if it's company or corporation, but those changes may have enabled them to be the sole supplier this time around. Still, it is expected that Samsung might be back with just about 30% of the orders for A11 chips for the iPhone 8 next year. And I think the thought there is that the iPhone 8 is looking to be a much more feature-rich, newer version of the iPhone. It looks like Apple's moving from the TikTok cycle to like a tick-tick-tock cycle. So, or would it be talk-talk-tick? I don't know. I always get confused on that. I think the ticks are supposed to be the big major changes. So I guess it would be tick, talk, talk, tick. And that tick cycle is expected to hit with the iPhone 7 because we've been hearing that, or with the iPhone 8 rather, because we've been hearing that the iPhone 7 is going to look largely the same as the current generation of devices, although it's going to have some nice new features. We're going to talk about that here in a second. But many are expecting that the iPhone 7 is not going to sell as well as the iPhone 8 will. It's expected that demand for the iPhone 8 is going to be higher as Apple adds in new features like OLED displays and integrated Touch ID sensors, all that fancy stuff that gets consumers really, really excited. Another latest news bit of information, or rumor rather, with the iPhone 7 is that a spy shot supposedly surfaced from internally at Foxconn. This was a slide from, I guess it was supposed to be an internal meeting at Foxconn, and it listed a couple features that we haven't heard rumored before. It claims that the iPhone 7 is going to have wireless charging support, and I know we've talked about, will it have wireless charging, will it not? It's looking like it's going to have a lightning connector, so I assume wireless charging support means that you're going to have an option to do wireless charging if you'd like, and I think that's a nice compromise. I think that's a good way to go. I probably commented earlier that I didn't think, you know, we really needed it. It doesn't seem to me like wireless charging is a great great way to go. But the more that I think about it, if you're able to have both, that's good. I'd kind of hope that they'd leave, you know, it out so that they can have more battery life. But if they can add it in and not really compromise battery life, I guess for those people who'd like the option of wireless charging, it's a good thing. And I heard from many of you, which kind of turned my opinion on this whole thing around, because there are a couple of cases to be made for times when you might want wireless charging. And then the other part of this slide, it also showed that the iPhone was going to have an IP68 water and dust resistance rating. And what that means is that the 6 means completely dustproof, and the 8 is that the equipment is suitable for continuous immersion in water under conditions that shall be specified by the manufacturer. So whatever that means, basically means that you're able to dunk it for an extended period of time, put it underwater. It's not, I don't think, technically waterproof. It's still water resistant, but very water resistant. And that would jive in line with the idea that Apple is ditching the headphone jack so that they can have better waterproofing, or one of the reasons they're ditching it would be that they could have better waterproofing in the iPhone 7. So I think it's a pretty strong case to be made that wireless charging support and an IP68 water resistance rating is going to be in the iPhone 7. And I think those would be very welcome features and probably well received by consumers. And then finally, you know, there's been this debate going on, is the iPhone 7 going to be really enough to compel most consumers to want to upgrade, or is it going to be another flop or another, and I don't like to say that word flop, because I don't think the iPhone 6S was a flop, but it didn't see a rise in iPhone sales. And we've talked about this on the show. I think we're entering a period where we've passed what people call peak iPhone, you know, the large sales numbers, and we're going to start to see a slow decline with little bumps up, you know, year over year for certain models. And it's sounding like the iPhone 8 is going to be the next bump up. I don't think the iPhone 8 is ever going to reach the sales numbers of, say, the iPhone 6, but we're going to have to wait and see. And because the iPhone 7 is rumored to look the same as the iPhone 6S, a lot of people are saying, well, it's not going to be appealing to consumers. There's not going to be enough new features in there. Well, Daniel Aaron Dilger over at Apple Insider wrote a great piece. I'm going to link to it in the show notes at maccast.com, because you really should read it. But the gist is that it's not just about the exterior of the phone. It's not about an all-new design, although that's the thing that consumers see. So it does, to a certain degree, drive sales, right? When there's a major form factor change, people get a little more excited because it's something that they can see. But he points out in this piece, people forget about all the stuff that's going on the inside that makes it a new phone. And so a lot of people are saying, well, the iPhone 7 is not going to be a new iPhone. And he's making the argument, what's not new about the iPhone 7? If you look at things like the processor, brand new A10 custom silicon. If you look at historically how Apple goes with their processors, moving from A8 to A9 or A7 to A8, they typically double, if not do better, with performance of both the CPU and the GPU. So screaming fast, they usually offer improved battery life, better sensors, motion tracking, you know, motion coprocessor is improved for better health and fitness features. You also get faster I/O, faster memory, advanced security features, powering new software features. It really is a whole new heart of the system, and it's a significant upgrade, even again, if you can't see it in the external casing. You've also got the all new camera system with advanced signal image processing. The new dual lens system is going to be amazing. I think the camera is going to be one of those standout features with the iPhone 7, or at least the iPhone 7 Plus. But the dual lens system is going to bring things like depth perception, image correction, expanded dynamic range and exposure, better color gamut. So real big improvements in the camera system, and Apple does that with almost every release. You've got integration of all these new hardware advancements with iOS 10 software. And I think iOS 10 is going to make even older phones feel like they're brand new. I'm really excited about the software enhancements in iOS 7, but couple that with the new hardware and things get even better. You've got new display technology and features like True Tone, DCI P3 wide color gamut. So bring some of those iPad Pro screen technologies into the display in the iPhone 7. I think that's very likely to happen. And those are big new significant features. You've also got audio and sound enhancements, updated speaker and mic systems. But, you know, by all means, let's just focus on the fact that Apple's removing the headphone jack and that's going to make everybody angry. Let's not look at all the other audio enhancements that are going to be in the system. And I think, you know, the headphone jack thing, it's going to boil up and a lot of people are going to be angry. But I have a feeling, just like other things that we've seen when there's major changes, design changes like that, I think it's going to taper off and fall away pretty quick. I think people are going to adapt pretty quickly. But, you know, let's just focus on, hey, the case isn't changing. Oh, the antenna line is moving a little bit, but that's just not enough. So because it looks the same, well, meh, I don't really care. No, I mean, you look at all of these things, and that's the point of this article, and the iPhone 7 starts to look like a very attractive device. I know after reading Daniel's piece, I'm much more excited about it. So I'm looking forward to see what actually gets announced. I'm hoping to see some significant image enhancements with the camera on the iPhone 7 as well as the 7 Plus. I'm hoping I'm not going to want to go back to the larger phone just to get the camera system, but I could if it's got a nice optical zoom and some of these other, you know, depth of field, adaptive focus features. That sounds kind of exciting, and I might want to have that. I might suffer again with a gigantophone. We'll see. If you listen to the show, you know that I hated my iPhone 6 Plus. It was just way too big. I never want to go back, but Apple, dang you, you're probably going to force me to. We'll see. Samsung is likely going to be producing OLED panels for Apple's iPhone 8 in 2017. So it's not expected they're going to change the display technology, at least in terms of moving from an LCD to an OLED display this year. That's going to happen likely with the iPhone 8. There were conflicting rumors that Samsung may or may not have spun off their OLED business. The reason I supposedly many thought they were going to be separating it was to kind of compensate for declining LCD panel sales. Their LCD panel business is on the decline as more companies move from LCD to OLED. And the thought there was like, if they spin it off, then they can kind of quietly shutter the LCD business or slow it down. Samsung later responded to the reports, though, saying that it did not spin off its OLED business and that it plans to continue developing both LCD and OLED products, at least for the near future. And then lastly this week, with respect to what's happening with iPhone, we got some reports that Apple has been adding a number of new suppliers. And some people are saying that this is a ploy for the company to try and get better deals from some of their existing suppliers, that Apple is really starting to tighten the screws on budgets, really trying to get really, really good deals on component parts for the next generation iPhone. Reportedly, Sharp is being added to a list of Apple OLED suppliers for those future iPhones. That's something typically Apple's used LG and Samsung for their displays. They may be adding Sharp at this point. And Apple is supposedly looking for better deals so that they can keep margins up amid slowing iPhone sales, which makes a lot of sense. You know, as iPhone sales are going to start to decline year over year a little bit, Apple's going to want to make more for each phone that they sell. So one way they can do that is cutting costs on the front end on the component parts. Now, supposedly suppliers are feeling the squeeze, and what we're seeing in the supply chain is them reporting lower sales estimates and also warning potentially against even losses moving into the future. Now, I'm not really convinced any of this is really new news. It's always been reported that Apple has been extremely aggressive when negotiating supplier contracts and that they use their clout and the sizable orders along with their reputation to try and get what they want. I think that's ultimately just good business. So I don't know that they're doing anything new here. Maybe the fact that they're sourcing parts from more suppliers might be something, but that too has been a strategy for a long time and something that Tim Cook has even commented on in the quarterly results calls. I think it's another reason why he says you can't trust the supply chain rumors, because you never know how many suppliers we have, what suppliers we're dealing with. So you might look at one supplier and see declining orders and think we're not ordering as much, but they could have another supplier over here that no one's even heard about or knows about yet. So it's kind of hard to tell what's going on when you're looking at the supply chain, and you can see why. You know, we're just seeing that Apple is looking for better and better deals on iPhone component parts that they may be outsourcing and putting different vendors head-to-head against each other to get the best price, something they've always done. And it's ultimately just good business, but it was talked about a little bit this week, so I wanted to bring it up. Another big story that happened this week is that Spotify is a little miffed at Apple. I think Spotify has always been miffed at Apple, but this time around, they submitted an update to the App Store that was summarily rejected and caused the company to throw out several statements implying that Apple was engaging in, quote, anti-competitive behavior. In a letter to Apple's general counsel, Bruce Sewell, they claim that Apple's App Store policies are, quote, causing grave harm to Spotify and its customers. And really what they're mad about is the 30% cut that Apple takes on in-app purchases, or more specifically for Spotify, in-app purchases of their subscriptions, or in-app subscriptions. I don't know how we term that. And they sent the same letter that they sent to Bruce Sewell to Senator Elizabeth Warren, who later in the same week made statements accusing Apple of using its platform dominance to hurt competitors like Spotify. So they kind of got some play and some press. And, you know, the app update that triggered this whole kerfuffle was rejected because of, quote, business model rules. Now, details were not given as to exactly what the app update did to break the rules, but according to reports, Spotify was told that they would be required to use Apple's iTunes-based billing system to sell subscriptions through their iOS app. So my assumption based on that comment is that they were somehow trying to change or bypass the Apple in-app purchase rule on subscriptions, which this is a rule that they've played by, they're currently playing by. They know that they can't go outside those bounds. They know they can't do things like link out to their website to sell subscriptions. And I can only assume that because they knew that stuff, that they specifically submitted this app update knowing that it would get rejected so that they could put out this letter, make the case in the public arena and, you know, in the media and bring it to the attention of the U.S. Senate. And, you know, basically they're angry. Now, Apple's Bruce Sewell came back and responded saying, our guidelines are applied equally to all app developers, whether they are game developers, ebook sellers, video streaming services, or digital music distributors, and regardless of whether or not they compete against Apple. So they're making the argument, look, the playing field has always been the same. It's always been level. This is why it's level. The guidelines apply to everyone. And he goes on to mention that they did not modify their rules or behavior when Apple became a competitor to Spotify, when they released Apple Music. But I have a feeling that could be exactly where Apple may have an issue. That's kind of the point, right? That the dynamics have changed. The landscape has changed a bit. So Apple could argue, you know what? We're not setting up special rules for everyone. Spotify, you have the same rules as Tidal, as same rules as any other subscription music service. Well, now Apple's on the scene. They have their own service in the App Store. They don't, I guess they could pay themselves the 30%, but it doesn't matter, right? So they could play by the rules, but the money's going to Apple. So the point is that maybe this does give them a slight competitive advantage. Is it anti-competitive, though, really becomes the question. And I think that's a little bit grayer. It's kind of harder to answer. I'm not saying that I feel Apple is being anti-competitive in their behavior, but I can see how Spotify could possibly have a stronger case for it now than they could have before Apple Music came on the scene, right? Remember, Apple also doesn't allow an app to use any other in-app payment service or, again, link to an outside website to sign up customers. And Spotify customers need to, you know, would need to subscribe outside the iOS app first to get the best rate. Inside the app, I think they charge $12.99 for a subscription versus $9.99. But the reality at the end of the day is I think that customers are smart enough to know how to get the best deal. And if they want to use Spotify with iOS, they're going to subscribe with or without an in-app purchase subscription sign up. And I think they'll even be willing to sign up in iOS if they perceive it as being more convenient, even though they know it costs a little bit more. And in fact, Spotify even noted publicly recently that their paid subscriber rates actually went up and not down when Apple Music became available, because it raised general awareness for music subscription services. So, you know, it sort of all ships were raised when Apple hit the scene. So, you know, and then the other part of this story that needs to be pointed out is at the same time, just before WWDC, Apple did announce new rules for in-app subscription purchases that actually reduce the fee collected on subscriptions if the customer stays subscribed after the first year. So what happens now is when the customer first signs up, Apple still gets their 30% on whatever the subscription rate is. But when the next year comes around, if that same customer renews, the fee goes down to 15% from the original 30% of the subscription price. So it has gotten a little bit better for the in-app subscriptions, but still, if you're not Apple and Apple Music, you're going to have to pay that if you want to sell subscriptions in-app on iOS. And that's really what Spotify is taking issue with. And it's going to be played out, I think, in the court of public opinion. I'm sure we're going to see some court cases on this, and you're going to hear senators and people on both sides speaking out. As far as how I feel about it, I know I think maybe it is time for Apple to change a little bit, but they've already taken a first step towards that change with this new subscription rate. And I don't know that they need to do more than that. I don't think that they need to offer up to, you know, to Spotify or any other subscription music service a special deal. And that really seems to be what's being asked for here. They want different treatment than, say, an app developer. And it's a slippery slope for Apple, because if they modify the rules for one group, then you know that other groups are going to come in and ask for the same sorts of modifications. So I can kind of see it from Apple's point as well. It's going to be interesting to watch. And if you have an opinion on this, please send a comment or an email, maccast@gmail.com. There was one other story that kind of hit this week related to Apple and Music. There was a rumor that Apple may acquire Tidal from Jay-Z. The Wall Street Journal cited sources with, quote, people familiar on the matter, that Apple was in exploratory talks with Tidal about a possible purchase. But when asked, a Tidal spokesman said that executives had not held talks with Apple, and even the Wall Street Journal piece noted that if the talks are happening, they may not even result in a deal. So this is kind of really early stage stuff at best, and Tidal saying it's not happening at all. But it still led to the speculation, you know, why would Apple be interested in Tidal? What's the deal there? Well, Tidal currently has about 4.2 million paying subscribers. And what's interesting about Tidal is they actually have two subscription service levels. They have a $10 a month level that is standard definition music, and then they have a $20 a month level that's actually higher definition music. So not all of those 4.2 million subscribers are at the lower rate. Some of them are at this higher rate, so they're technically maybe a premium subscriber. But still, Apple has about 15 million paid subscribers on Apple Music now, so 4.2 million, it'd be a nice addition to, you know, Apple's subscriber base, but there's no guarantee that all those all those people would move over, that they wouldn't jump ship and maybe go to another service like Spotify. But, you know, Apple could gain 1 million, 2 million subscribers by purchasing Tidal. Not anything to sniff at, but probably not exactly what Apple would be after. Another thing Apple could potentially be after is one of Tidal's key technology features, which is this high-quality lossless audio, the high-definition stuff. And they also offer up high-definition music videos. Again, something that I think would be great as an Apple Music subscriber to have. Is it really what Apple needs or would be willing to pay a lot of money to Tidal to get? Maybe, maybe not. But the engineering talent behind that, that may be very, very valuable and worth the purchase. So my bet is that Apple's after the engineers, maybe after the high-quality lossless audio technology that those engineers have been putting together. They would bring that talent into play, bring it into Apple Music, and Apple could improve their audio format, their audio streaming quality, and I think that would be good for Apple Music. The last thing, and probably the biggest deal for Apple, is that Tidal does have support from a pretty impressive list of top-tier artists in the music industry. So you got Kanye West, Beyonce, Madonna. They also are the only service to have the full streaming rights to the entire catalog of Prince. I think that would be very valuable. So I think between the industry relationships, the musician relationships, and the engineering talent that's over there, this would be actually a pretty good acquisition for Apple. And I guess there is kind of one last reason why Apple might want to buy Tidal, and that would be so that one of their competitors, like Play or Spotify, doesn't do it. And that could happen as well. So I would expect that we will see Apple buy Tidal. This seems to make sense to me, although, you know, the rumor mill is kind of split on this one. I guess as the song says, the times, they are a-changin', especially if you're an Apple fan in New York City. The independent Apple reseller and service center TechServe is going to shut down after 29 years of operation. This is a pretty sad story, in my opinion, although I really wish I could say it was, you know, atypical, but unfortunately it's not. TechServe has been hanging in there for a while. And unfortunately now they're saying their service center is going to be shutting down on July 31st and their retail operation on West 23rd Street is expected to close on August 15th. And in the end, unfortunately, around 70 people are going to be losing their jobs. And they're saying the reason is increased rent costs and the high availability of other outlets for Apple customers, mainly New York City's 7 Apple retail stores and the many, many Best Buy stores. Also, growing online options have proven just too much for the indie shop to apparently remain sustainable. And it's really sad to see, but it's a story that has hit many an independent Apple retailer and service center across the nation and really across the globe. I hear this story all the time, and you don't hear about all the, you know, small Apple authorized shops and retailers and resellers that are shutting down in small towns and different places all over the place. And if you're lucky enough to still have an indie shop in your area, relish it. I'm very lucky that we still here have one, Crywolf Computers, and they are great over there. If you haven't been to your local independent Apple retailer or Apple service center, go and visit them, buy something, or two things or more, you know, buy your computer there. Consider going to them before you go to the Apple store or the Genius Bar next time. And the reason is many of these places are still a bastion of much more personalized service, better experience, a higher level of customer care. They are going to be very happy that you're there. I can guarantee you, when you walk into an Apple retail store, as great as that experience is, I don't want to detract from it, and as great as the people are in those places, and there are really great people working at Apple stores as well, you know, they're not going to care that much if you're there or not. Whereas your independent reseller, they really care about each and every customer that walks through that door. And I guess I don't want to imply that Apple retail doesn't, but it's the difference between, you know, that big operation and the little one. You're going to make much more of an impact with the little guy than you are in, you know, the Big Apple retail store in most cases. And I can also almost guarantee, without a doubt, there is not going to be a several day wait period to be seen for service at your local Apple authorized dealer, independent authorized dealer versus an Apple retail store. Anybody who's gone online to make an appointment at the Genius Bar knows that that can be a pain. Although we know the workaround too, right? You can go in for a walk-in appointment, and that's typically what I do when I go into an Apple retail store. You can get in, but again, you know, it's just a whole different experience at a whole different level. So if you're lucky enough to have an indie shop in your area, please go visit them, check them out, give them a shot. You know, you may find that you like the experience a little bit better. And they are, as you can see here, a dying breed. 29 years, TechServe. It is an institution. It was featured on an episode of Sex and the City. I mean, this is a big deal. A lot of people, if you've ever lived in New York and you're an Apple fan, you know about TechServe. So a little bit of a sad state, but you know, it's one of those things that is happening. And then finally, in the news for this week, oh, I got two stories left in the news for this week. I almost ended the news section a little bit too early. First off, Apple has some new beta builds out. The beta 2 builds are out for iOS 10, macOS Sierra, watchOS 3, and tvOS. The only thing notable that I noticed on the updates was something in iOS 10. There is a rest finger to unlock on the home screen option. So you can now put your finger on the home button, unlock the home screen without, or unlock the lock screen rather, without launching the home screen. And then if you want to go to the home screen, you just simply press the home button and you're in. You also have the press home to unlock gesture if you want to do it all in one fell swoop. But again, it's going to be nice to, with the faster Touch ID sensor, to not always be breezing past the notifications, you know, on the lock screen, which oftentimes that's what I want to see. And I haven't seen those in a year since getting my iPhone 6S. So I'm really looking forward to that change in iOS 10. Apple also did release an updated tvOS remote app, and it adds in the game controller support. So there's now a game controller icon on that. You can tap it, and then you'll get a game controller layout with the trackpad on the left and select and play pause buttons on the right. So it works more like a gaming controller. Apple also released animated sticker emoji packs for the iOS 10 iMessage store. So you can get those if you're a beta tester. Another cool thing is we found out that iOS 10, the health app, is going to offer a one-tap option to sign up to become an organ donor, an eye donor, or a tissue donor. So that's going to make that much easier for you to get involved if you want to become an organ or tissue donor. And then Mac, 9to5Mac is reporting that the always listening Siri option is finally, thank you Apple, getting smarter in iOS 10. You know, if you own any number of iOS devices and you use the, you know, voice command to activate Siri, which I'm not going to say because I don't want to set off everybody's devices, you know that they will all start responding. So I have an Apple Watch, an iPhone, and an iPad all set up with always on Siri listening, and I can give a command and often all three will start executing that command. With iOS 10, things are about to get smarter because nearby devices are going to respond, but, you know, wake up, but only one is going to take the request. One is going to respond. So the way this works, if you see the video that 9to5 put out, briefly you'll see the waveform animation on all your devices, but then suddenly one device will say, hey, nope, I got this one, I'm going to take over, and instantly all the other ones stop working or stop listening. And it's unclear how the quote-unquote winner is chosen. In 9to5's test, they noticed that in most cases their iPad won out, but I think it was a new iPad Pro, and that may just be because it's a little bit faster on the draw. So it's likely that whichever device is the first to kind of process the voice command will be the winner, and that's often going to be whatever your fastest device is. And so that appears to be how it works now, and The assumption is they're using low energy Bluetooth signals to probably tell the other devices, nope, I've got this. You can shut down. I'm gonna take this Siri command. But thank goodness that is been a frustration for me over the last year or two, and I'll be glad to see that one go away. But that's kind of the latest with the betas. I'm sure we'll get more information on some of the new beta features, specifically in macOS Sierra, watchOS, and tvOS, and talk about those on some future episodes. But that's what I got for you for right now. And then now, really, the last story in the news for this week, a new Mac malware has been spotted by Bitdefender, a research lab. They've provided details of a new malware targeting Macs called backdoor.mac.eleanor. Let's just call her Eleanor for short. So there's an Eleanor exploit. It's being distributed via a malicious drag-to-drop file converter app called Easy Doc Converter. So if you've installed this, you may want to listen up close to this story. It's, you know, out there. It's in the wild. It's even available on Mac download sites like Mac Update, which a lot of people would be, you know, consider to be a pretty legitimate download site. But needless to say, the app doesn't do anything that it claims to do. It simply installs a backdoor exploit on your system, and it uses a number of techniques to allow hackers to get at your system. The first thing it does is install a local hidden web server via the Tor network. And then it posts that web server's address to the Pastebin network so that, you know, the bad guys can find your machine and start hacking on it. And how can they hack on it? Well, guess what? That web server lets them do it in a number of different ways. It installs all kinds of command and control access points so scripts can be run to allow access to your file manager so they can view, edit, rename, delete, download, upload, archive your files. They can do command execution to execute commands, script execution using PHP, Perl, Python, Ruby, Java. And basically, it gives them full access to your system. They can access the shell. They can bind and reverse the shell connection, basically allowing them to execute root commands. They can do simple packet crafting, probe your firewalls, reset rules, find different entry points. This thing is nasty. They can connect and administer your databases, process, you know, task and list managers, look at what processes are running on your system, all that sort of stuff. Send emails with attachments. Of course they can send emails, right? They want to use your thing as a spam bot, which is probably a lot of what this is all about. But the thing is nasty. But here is now why, after, you know, scaring you to death, which is what many of these news stories are doing, here's why I will tell you that for most of us, we do not need to worry. Because the app that's being distributed right now is unsigned, which means that if you're using Apple's Gatekeeper feature, and that would be on by default if you're running a current version of OS X, then this will not install. It will not run. You cannot, even if you downloaded it, it's not going to let you run it. It's going to warn you that it's an unsigned app and will fail to launch. If you want to check and make sure your Gatekeeper settings are set correctly, go into System Preferences, Security and Privacy, General, and then make sure the Allow Apps Downloaded From option is either set to Mac App Store Only or Mac App Store and Identified Developers. As long as it's one of those two settings and not that third one that says, you know, install anything from anywhere, you're good to go and you shouldn't get hit by this. It's also expected that Apple will update its OS X Protect anti-malware list so that you can't even install this no matter what. And that probably will have happened by the time you hear this podcast. So we're really protected by the measures that Apple has in place, or most of us are. But it's still likely that the profile of this exploit could be used to make other variants of this virus. So this may just be the tip of the iceberg, and we've seen this happen before. You know, this exploit could end up in a developer signed app, could end up in the Mac App Store. Hopefully, the app reviewers will find it before that happens. But stuff occasionally does slip through. So really, the best protection you can have is being proactive. Don't install any apps from developers or sources you don't know or trust. And if you're ever in doubt about an application, you know, if you found some new utility through Reddit or, you know, some bulletin board message system and you're unsure about it, do a little upfront research. Check it out. You know, see if other people are using this. Does it work? You know, what have you found? It would be hard to figure out, you know, from other people who maybe tried to install this that, guess what? Hey, it's not doing what it says it does. And that would be a huge red flag. And I would imagine some simple Google searching could find that kind of information. So a little upfront research when you're in doubt can make a whole world of difference. You know, just being smart about how you're using your computer. And I know you're smart about that already. But, you know, we got to let people know when these exploits happen and when they do or don't need to panic. And really on this one, I think we can stay calm and carry on, to use an overused meme. But with that, that is going to do it for the news for this week. Before we move on, I do want to take another moment and thank another one of our show sponsors, and that is iMazing. This is a great tool that lets you access, view, backup, and manage the data on your iOS devices. And you might be thinking, well, I can use iTunes for that, right? Yeah, you can, but not in the way that you can with iMazing. iMazing gives you direct access to that underlying data. It lets you get at just about everything and lets you do it with no jailbreaking required. You can manage and interact with data from messages, photos and videos, music apps, notes, contacts, your voicemail, your call history. You can extract your voicemail and call history using iMazing. You can get into the file system. You can look at the backups and the data files that are in your apps. This is actually a great way if you have an app that doesn't sync its data through the cloud and you need to do that dreaded erase and, you know, rebuild, you know, set up your iPhone as new. You install that app and you suddenly realize all its data is missing. Well, guess what? You can use iMazing to go back into your backup files, grab the components for that app, and load them back into the app that's on your, you know, the new version of the app that's installed on your iPhone. I've done this with games to get game history back. It is a lifesaver. And it has a very familiar Apple-like interface. It works fast and asynchronously, which means you can continue to work while it's doing different operations. So if you've started a backup of your photo files or maybe your messages, you can continue to work on other areas while that's going on in the background. And it will even give you access to browse files, like I said, that are in your backups, which is really great for re-importing saved data. And best of all, you can try it for free. And when you order, you get 20% off if you use the coupon code MACCAST. All you have to do is go to iMazing.com, iMazing.com. You can get all of the details. Check it out. It is a great app, and I use it. You're actually going to hear about that here in a moment. But a big thank you to iMazing for their support of the MACCAST. So last episode, I told you about this issue I was having. I have this new 15-inch Retina MacBook Pro. I have a bunch of external drives that I have hooked up to a USB hub. And since getting the new machine, I was getting this issue where drives were unmounting and remounting themselves randomly. And it even got so bad that I lost a couple drives. I lost one of my Time Machine backup drives and one of my clone backup drives. And luckily, it was the drive didn't fail. It's just the data became corrupted and I was able to rebuild them and kind of start over. But it was a big pain. And so I talked about a potential solution that I found, and that seems to be working. But I also asked you to kind of comment if you were having this issue. And Gary wrote in to confirm that he did have this issue as well a while back. And all of his sort of research pointed to a USB hub that he had. And that was one of the things when I was doing the research to figure out what was going on that a lot of people were pointing to. They were saying, look, if you have a powered USB hub, it might not be supplying enough power to your drives. So when your Mac goes to sleep and the signals are going, the drives think that they don't have power going to them and they shut down. And then you wake up your Mac and your Mac says, oh, the drives are gone. And what Gary found with his troubleshooting is that simply replacing his USB hub and also moving to non-USB powered drives. Those two factors were able to resolve his issue. So he was not getting, you know, USB drives that were bus powered. Now, in my case, I use almost all exclusively USB bus powered drives, and I prefer those because I don't want the extra cables. But if you're willing to have an extra power cable, that is a good way to kind of keep the power consistent. I mentioned that I use a Satechi USB 3.0 10 port hub, and I had no issues with it prior to getting this 15-inch Retina MacBook Pro. So with my 2011 MacBook Pro, it worked fine. So I kind of ruled out. I didn't think this was a hub issue per se, although, again, another one of the fixes, if you're having this problem, is to directly plug your USB drives into your Mac. My problem is that I think I have four USB powered drives plus USB powered drive. So I've got five hard drives hooked up to this one Mac and only two USB ports. So it's just not going to work out without a hub. But I want to report back on the fix that I mentioned last week because it does seem to be holding up. I only had one incident with, you know, incidentally, my Time Machine backup drive, which is that powered USB drive. It did disconnect and reconnect one time since we spoke last. But in the past week since I implemented my fix, things seem to be going well. So I want to share, again, all the details of what I did. So I went into the system preferences, or I went into the hard drive on my Mac, the root hard drive, into the root library folder, into the preferences folder, and if you scroll all the way down to the bottom of that list, you'll see a folder called system configuration file. Now remember, this is just if you're having this problem where you're waking up your Mac and you're getting that message that says, hey, you didn't eject your drives properly, or your drive unexpectedly, you know, disconnected. If you're having that issue, this could potentially solve that. So drill into the root of your hard drive, library preferences, and look for the system configuration folder. Find that folder, take it, and move it into the trash. You're probably going to be prompted to enter your admin username and password because this is a protected folder. But put it into the trash and then reboot your system. And what should happen is that should get rebuilt. Now, you'll probably have to readjust some of your preferences because that has things like some of your network configuration preferences and stuff like that. You may have to reset that stuff. I didn't really have to do that. It seemed to work out fine, but I'm just warning you that may come up. And then I tried that originally, and that fix worked for about a week, and then I started having trouble again. So I decided to look into a couple other settings, and I went into Settings, Energy Saver. I unchecked the box that says put hard disks to sleep when possible. I did that both for being powered and running powered and on battery. And then I also, in that same panel, Settings, Energy Saver, checked the prevent computer from sleeping automatically when the display is off. And I think that option is only available when you're powered. So did those two things. And then finally, I went into Settings, Spotlight, Privacy. And I keep saying Settings. I think I mean System Preferences. So System Preferences, Spotlight, Privacy. And I added all the external drives to not be indexed by Spotlight. And with all of those things done, I have had no issues. Now, what I don't know is that last step. I don't know if that would be required, but one of the things when I was doing my research that was noted was that some people thought the Spotlight indexing might be causing this issue. So I decided to take a stab at that. So I might go back and start to remove each one of these things and see if the issue comes back and kind of troubleshoot it a little bit more. But that's what's been working for me, and I wanted to share that final solution just in case there's others of you out there that might be suffering the same problems. And I know there's quite a few people because, again, as mentioned on the last show, there's a 31-page discussion thread going back a couple years, I think all the way back to OS X Mavericks on this issue. And thank you, Gary, for chiming in and kind of sharing your thoughts on this issue. The other thing we talked about last episode was iDevice life hacks. I kind of gave you some life hacks for the iPhone and asked if you might have any for your Apple devices that you wanted to share. And John came back this week with a tip on dealing with thick cases and headphones. So he mentioned, you know, when you have like a battery case that is particularly thick, like a Mophie or something like that, or maybe you just have one of those ruggedized cases for your iPhone, it can sometimes be hard to pull or unplug the headphone jack without having to yank on the cable, because a lot of times the little, you know, little part on the end that you're supposed to pull on, it's embedded so deep in that case that you really have no other option but to pull on the cable. And as you know, pulling on the cable is not necessarily the best thing. It's a way, you know, that your cable is likely going to break at that point. So John mentioned a good fix for this problem, which is to create a little pull tab just out of like cellophane tape, you know, packing, not packing tape, but gift wrap tape. You know what I'm talking about, cellophane tape. And he said, you know, take a piece about an inch and a quarter to an inch and a half long, fold it over so that you have a little half inch tail of the adhesive. And then with that little tail part, wrap that around the end of the earphone plug so that the folded over part wraps up around the cable. And then when you insert it into your case, once you need to remove the headphone jack, you can simply pull on that little tape tab and you'll be pulling directly on the plug rather than on the cable itself. And I thought that was a really great tip. Another tip that was sent in came from Richard, and his was for quieting a noisy Apple keyboard. And I guess Richard said he has one of the new Apple Magic keyboards, which is really thin, right? And it sits flat on the desk. Now, I don't have one of these yet, but I still have one of Apple's aluminum wireless keyboards, and it can make a little bit of noise, especially if you have a firm hand for typing. And or firm fingers, I guess. And so what Richard did was he actually flipped his keyboard over and used some dense foam strips and little pads on the underside of that Magic keyboard to just dampen some of the vibrations that were created when he was typing on the keyboard, especially on a hard surface. And he said it worked great for dampening a lot of the sound. I guess he works also in, you know, an office environment, and his loud typing could be disturbing to coworkers in, you know, the cubicle next door. So another great tip for your Apple keyboard. And then finally, one that I forgot to mention last episode that I think is pretty cool. A lot of people don't know that the little minifigures from Lego make actually great little holders for Apple cables. The little hand is the perfect size for an Apple cable, like a Lightning cable or an iPod cable. And what you do is you can either create a little stand for your desktop and then put the minifigure into that and then, you know, put the cable in its hand. Or I did this. I took some glue or epoxy and attached a little base plate to the side of my desk. You could also, I guess, do it to the top of your desk. And then you can attach the minifig to that and hang your cables off of it. And it's kind of a cool little accessory, a way to show off your minifigs and also get them to serve a little function. Get them working for you, those dang minifigs. They've been freeloading for way too long. But another cool little life hack for your Apple products and iOS devices. And again, I'm sure you have many more. And if you'd like to share them with us, shoot me an email, mattcast@gmail.com. Or even better yet, send in a 2-3 minute long audio comment sharing your tip with us, and we'll try and share those out on future episodes of the MacCast. Another question I received this week came in from listener Adam, and it's actually a question that's baffled me for a while as well. He says he has an iPad Air 2, and he's using iCloud Photo Library, and he has the optimized iPad storage option checked on. So this is the option where it's going to keep the larger size originals in the cloud and only put optimized versions on your iPad. And what he noticed was that even though he doesn't take any photos on his iPad, on the iPad itself, his photo library shows that he has 7,000 photos and that it's using 6.81 gigabytes of storage on his device. And his question was, you know, why is it using so much storage? And not only that, his iPhone 6 is also using 6.81 gigabytes of storage for his iCloud photo library or his photo library with the same 7,000 images, which you would expect, right? Because everything's supposed to sync across all the devices. But the question became, how does the local storage of photos work when the optimized storage box is checked? And actually, the answer is, I think only Apple knows the mystery of the black box that is the iCloud photo library. I have no idea. But it's still not going to stop me from, you know, doing some research, looking at some data, and making some of my own theories, and also, you know, rehashing some theories that are online and speculating wildly about how this feature actually works. So the first thing you need to know is that iCloud Photo Library, even with the optimize option on, still uses a fair amount of storage, as you've noticed. What's really weird is that amount seems to vary from device to device. I know in your case, Adam, it was the same on the iPhone and the iPad, but for a lot of us, it's not the same. And so it's like, what the heck is going on here? You know, what's the difference? But what happens when you turn on that optimize option is basically it's going to pull down images to your device, but they are going to be, just as it says, optimized or downsized for that screen size in that version of the device. And those optimized versions are even used for editing. But what's cool is that the edits are actually synced up with the full-sized images that are stored in iCloud and maybe on your Mac or any other device that you've chosen to use the download and keep originals option with. We've talked about in the past that my philosophy is you should probably pick just one Mac that has that setting and all the other devices and Macs in your environment that are sharing the same iCloud photo library should be using the optimize option. But depending upon the size of your iPhoto library, it sounds like yours is about 7,000 images, that can still be a significant chunk of space, that optimized option. And in looking over some of my stats, here is what I see. So what I did was I pulled up iMazing and I actually browsed directly on my iPhone and my iPad to the photo data folders and looked at what was in there. And I also compared that to some of the information that was showing in the usage section in the settings on my iPhone. And so on my Mac, in photos on my Mac, I have 22,818 photos with 31 videos. And my photo library on my Mac is 69.16 gigabytes. And I drilled into that and I looked at what are called the masters, which are supposedly the original images. And then I looked at, you know, how much was being used by the rest of the system. And so 53.16 gigabytes was the master files, and that would leave about 16 gigabytes of thumbnails, metadata, and all of that other stuff. So still a significant chunk of storage. Now on my iPad Pro, where I am using the optimize option, the photo library uses about 9.2 gigabytes, and my iPad has about 16.6 gigabytes of free space. On my iPhone, however, which is also a 128 gigabyte device, the iPhoto library uses up 28 gigabytes, almost three times the amount of storage as the iPad Pro. And the difference is that while my iPad has 16.6 gigabytes of free space, the iPhone has 45.4 gigabytes of free space. And I'm only mentioning this now because a little bit later it comes into play, I think. So then using iMazing, drilling into the actual photo data itself, I wanted to see, you know, where is that storage on my iPad and my iPhone? How is that being divided up internally? And inside the photo data folder, which was 23.3 gigabytes, by the way, so there's 5.3 gigabytes I can't really account for. But on my iPhone, there were three different folders that seemed to use up the bulk of the storage. There was something called CPL Assets, which was 5 gigabytes. There was metadata, which was a 15 gigabyte folder, and that had what looked to me like those local optimized images. So the local versions of all the images in my iPhoto library, as near as I could tell, but, you know, downsized for the resolution of my iPhone. And then there was a thumbnails folder that was about 2.3 gigabytes. So that made up the bulk of the data that was on the phone. And so I'm not exactly sure what all these files do, but they certainly make up that optimized, you know, set. And so that being said, there also appears to be some decisions made by Apple in the operating system on just how optimized the optimized storage seems to be. And in researching online, the general consensus seems to be that it might be based on the amount of free storage that's available on your device. And I assume, just looking at how the library compared between my iPhone 6S and my iPad Pro, that the more available storage you have, the more optimized images it's going to pull down and store actually on your device. So your library could be slightly larger if you have a lot of free space. I think it's going to use up the free space that it's available. And now, how will it decide, you know, when it needs to purge and you know, how far will it go? Many online believe that iCloud Photo Library will use as much space as it wants until you've reached about 10% free disk space left, and then it will start to kind of clear and clean and optimize things. And if that's true, I would have expected my iPad Photo Library to be larger than 16.6 gigabytes, or to larger since I have 16.6 gigabytes of free space, rather. And I, you know, which is slightly more than that 10% of the total of my 128 gigabytes of storage. So that theory I'm not completely sold on, but I get the logic. I get why people would think that. And then finally, in looking at this, Apple's docs only say this about the optimized storage in iCloud Photo Library. Device-sized versions are kept on your device, and that seems to imply that the library will use as much space as it needs based on the size of your library alone. So again, those 7,000 images optimized for your iPhone and your iPad seem to, in your case, Adam, amount to that 6.81 gigabytes. In my case, the ones on my iPhone, 28.6 gigabytes of storage, my iPad Pro, 9.2 gigabytes. And again, this is where the theory falls down, because my iPad Pro images optimized for that would be much, much larger, right? So you would expect that library size to be larger. So that just leaves me back where we started, which is this is a mystery black box that only Apple understands. And just flip the switch and, you know, let it go, I guess. So there you have it, Adam. I hope. That's my understanding of optimized iCloud Photo Library storage and how it works, which is apparently no understanding at all. But it does seem to work. If you need free space, I don't know. Apple recommends clearing out your photo library, maybe breaking it up into smaller pieces, archiving some of your older files. But beyond that, you know, I don't know that there's much more you can do other than flip the switch and clean the library. All right. Yeah, how's that for not helping? If somebody really does know what's going on with this, let us know. I there's some clues in there, right? At least I gave you some clues, some direction to move in. All right, moving on. Another question on a black box technology from Apple, this time from listener Gary.
Hey, Adam, it's Gary. I wanted to comment on the Wi-Fi Assist feature on the iPhone. I use my iPhone to make a lot of FaceTime audio calls. It's my preferred way to talk to people when I can. And oftentimes I'm beginning a call in my house, which I think we talked about it a couple of times before. I have an AirPort Extreme router, and I also have an AirPort Express to extend my range a little bit. In general, the network works very well. In the house, I don't have any issues with continuous or contiguous calls or downloads. It's only when I have to like leave the house to walk my dog, that's the issue. And I thought that with the Wi-Fi Assist, or I think it's called Wi-Fi Assist feature, it would be better. And it seems to have gotten slightly better, or maybe it's just my Wi-Fi is stronger, or the antennas in the Wi-Fi are stronger. I can make it further, but when I am a certain distance away from the house, it doesn't seem to transition over to LTE as quickly as I would like. And I'm wondering what the Wi-Fi Assist is supposed to do, if anything. I did look at the statistics under Wi-Fi Assist. I scrolled down, and it's like 35 megabytes. That's the entire... I never reset it. That's the entirety of what it lists. And you can't really tell what exactly is it assisting, you know, when it does this. From what I understand, it's supposed to help when Wi-Fi is not strong enough or has stopped working altogether. Maybe there's just too much of a delay. Maybe it can't fail over to like a FaceTime audio call or something like that. But that's what I've been experiencing. Wondering if anyone else is experiencing something similar, something like that. So thanks again.
Hey, Gary. Yeah, I think I can try and help you, at least from the standpoint of explaining what it's supposed to do or how it's supposed to work. I don't know, though, that that's going to give you the answers to why you're not having or why you're having issues with the handoff. And I'll talk about that more in a minute. But let's first address kind of the main question, which is, what is Wi-Fi Assist supposed to do? And what it's supposed to do is hand off the data to the cellular network when you have a weak Wi-Fi signal, which is basically what you described. I mean, exactly what you're mentioning. That's what is your understanding of it is correct, basically. That's what it's supposed to do. Now, Apple, on its support page for Wi-Fi Assist, does note some caveats, although, as you're going to hear, I don't think these necessarily apply to you. They note that Wi-Fi Assist will not automatically switch to cellular if you're using data roaming. I don't think that's happening in your case. Wi-Fi Assist only works when you have apps running in the foreground and doesn't activate with background downloading of content. In your case, you mentioned FaceTime calls, so I'm assuming that you've got the FaceTime call in the foreground and it's not running in the background as you're doing other things. If that's the case, that may be part of the reason for the bad transition. And then it also notes that Wi-Fi Assist doesn't activate with some third-party apps that stream audio or video or download attachments like an email app, as they might use large amounts of data. Now, it specifically says third-party apps, but I guess technically it could also be that FaceTime just really doesn't support the Wi-Fi Assist feature, and maybe that's what you're experiencing. The only reason I say that's maybe, though, is because I've experienced exactly the same issues that you're describing. For me, it specifically manifests itself when I'm getting into the car. From my driveway, I have a very weak Wi-Fi signal to my house. And in that situation, I can't start to load podcasts. I really can't use Siri in the car. And it seems to hold on to my Wi-Fi network. It does not want to switch over to the cellular data connection, at least when I'm in my driveway. So I get this really bad transition. The minute I pull out and start to drive away, it flips over to the cellular and everything is good. So I have a feeling that, you know, even though Wi-Fi Assist kind of holds this promise of an easy transition from Wi-Fi to cellular, it's not really realized, and that's what you're experiencing. I think, you know, the technology just isn't that great, and it never has been that great. The whole transition thing has never worked out very well, and hopefully it's something that Apple can further fine-tune. I know Wi-Fi Assist is a relatively new feature in iOS, so hopefully it's just kind of the growing pains of getting it working, but it certainly is, you know, a bump in the road for a lot of us when we're transitioning from our Wi-Fi networks over to the cellular data networks. And I don't think it's anything more than that you're experiencing. The last thing that I have for you in the show for today is a way to get help with your Apple products anytime, anywhere. And no, it's not emailing mattcast@gmail.com, although that would actually work. That would be a great way to get help anytime, anywhere. But that's not the one that I want to talk to you about today. The one I want to talk to you about today is going through Apple. You know, Apple's website and Apple in general has a great set of resources for getting help. You've got the Genius Bar if you're lucky enough to have an Apple store near you. You've got Apple discussion boards, which are great. You've got the Apple support website online, which is great. Apple has tried to continuously improve apple.com/support, and I really do think it's getting better. But the other thing that you've probably experienced, and I know I experienced as well, is that getting to the various parts of the Apple support site that you want to get to can sometimes be a little bit of a challenge. It's become a little bit fragmented, although I think they're starting to pull everything back together. But often I can't remember how to get back to certain parts of the site that I want to get to. Like, there's this great page that has all of my support tickets and calls and all my product registrations and serial numbers. I can never remember how to get there. It's actually called the My Support Profile page. And the URL is supportprofile.apple.com. Supportprofile.apple.com. And if you go there, you can log in with your Apple ID and you can get all this great information about your repair tickets and which products you have registered and stuff like that. I find that page and I'm like, oh, this is awesome. I need to remember this. Of course, I forget to bookmark it. And then I can never find my way back. And I try to go through Apple's support website. I can't find a link to it anywhere. I can never remember what it's called. And so that gets frustrating. And this week, Greg wrote in with another great support option that Apple has a page for that I think is sometimes hard to find. And that is their support callback feature. And if you can find that, they have this great feature where you need support, phone support. You don't want to call up and just sit on hold. You can actually go to the website. You can fill out a form or, you know, go through a process. Select a time, a day and time, to have an Apple rep call you back. And they call you back. It's like a 15-minute window. And they do a great job of calling you back. Actually, an automated system calls you back and says, hey, when you're on the line and available, let us know, and then we'll connect you with your support technician, with your engineer. And it works awesome. But actually finding or getting to that page can be a little bit difficult. And so Greg shared that with that URL with us. It's getsupport.apple.com. And actually, this page has links to all the other pages and the wizards and the support help that I think is great. So mark this one down, getsupport.apple.com. There you can get to chat, you can get to message boards, you can get to phone support, you can schedule a call, which is the feature that Greg wrote in about, and it works awesome. And best of all, if you log in using the See Your Products link down at the bottom, on this page, you can actually see a list of all your registered products. You can select those, and then you can start to drill down on your specific issue based on the products you have registered. So you can say, look, I'm having trouble. There's my iPhone. That's the one with that serial number. You don't have to remember the serial number or look it up. You can click on it. You can get your repair history. You can get all that information from this one page, and it's really great. And the whole system works like a wizard and tries to walk you through and guide you quickly to the fastest resolution. And one of those resolutions can be, hey, talk to somebody. And you can do it again via chat. You can choose to call in. You can choose to have them give you this callback. And I really recommend the callback feature. I think you can also schedule a Genius Bar appointment from this section. So good, handy page to remember, getsupport.apple.com. And thank you, Greg, for sending in that tip. But with that, that is going to do it for this episode of the MacCast. Before I leave you, I do want to take a quick moment and thank all of my show sponsors: Smile, makers of Text Expander, PDF Pen, Disc Label, also Text Expander for iPhone and iPad, along with PDF Pen for iOS and PDF Pen Scan Plus. You can get more information and details on all of the great Smile applications over at smilesoftware.com. And Gazelle. Gazelle is the fast and simple way to sell your used gadgets. You can find out what your used iPhone, iPad, and other Apple products are worth at gazelle.com. Bandwidth for the MacCast is provided by Cachefly. They are at cachefly.com. And all advertising on the MacCast is handled by Backbeat Media. They are at backbeatmedia.com. And then one last thing kind of before I close out the show, I have to just mention that July is a crazy, crazy month for me. I am going to be on the road. I'm going to be traveling. I'm going to be taking vacation. Lots of stuff going on. I'm actually about to take my annual trip to Pismo Beach, camping for a week. And then immediately after that, I am going to be flying to Chicago for MacStock. I think I've told you about MacStock on the show before, but it is getting time. We're just about a week away. I'm going to be giving a talk there on steam-powered Apple, how to use your Apple products for science, technology, engineering, mathematics, and art education. Should be a lot of fun. I'm looking forward to meeting up with all the other speakers there. I do know that they still have tickets available, so if you head to MacStockExpo.com, I believe is the website. Hopefully I'm getting that right. Just search for MacStock 2016 on Google. And I think you can still get tickets. I'd love to see you there. If you are planning to be at MacStock, shoot me a message on Twitter, on email. Let me know you're going to be there. I'd love to connect, see you, chat. It would be great. I'm really looking forward to this trip. I think it's going to be a lot of fun. And then I'm off to some other places. I'm going to be in St. Louis and a couple other things going on, a friend's wedding in San Francisco. But it's going to be crazy, crazy times. So if the show gets a little bit sporadic, or if I miss an episode or dates, don't worry. I'm around. There will be shows. They are coming. But it's a little bit chaotic this month. And I just want to give you a heads up on that. But with that, that is going to do it for this episode of the MacCast. If you have a comment, a question, something you'd like to hear covered on a future episode, you can shoot me an email or an audio comment. You can send those to maccast@gmail.com. You can call in and leave a voicemail on the listener hotline. That number, 281-622-4269, 281-MAC-IM-9. If you need show notes, links to anything that I talked about on this or any other episode of the MacCast, you can find those on the website. That, of course, is at maccast.com. And while you're there, be sure to check out the forum at forum.maccast.com. And if you're on social media, you want to follow me on Twitter, twitter.com/MacCast, and I'll be, you know, posting camping photos and also all kinds of images and things from MacStock. So that's a great thing to do if you want to follow me right now on Twitter. You can also check out the MacCast Facebook page over at facebook.com/TheMacCast. And if you prefer Google Plus, we do have a Google Plus community. You'll find that at google.com/plusMacCast. That'll do it for now. Until next time, I will talk to you all again real soon.